A word of prophecy. Northern California will be struck by a devastating earthquake. You should be prepared. Now, you will have heard that prophecy before, that scientists who study, you know, moving plates of earth and so on have reasons accurate reasons, no one I know disbelieves them, that somewhere in our future a major earthquake is going to happen to this part of the world. But it's the kind of prophecy, the kind of prediction that sort of gets lost in its importance because it hasn't happened yet. And we know we should be prepared, and we sometimes do something about it, and we try to get ready, and then it just nothing happens. And the significance of this warning recedes. The title of the sermon this morning is "The End is Near." It's taken from one of the verses I'm going to read in just a moment, and it's also familiar to us. Any of us who know anything about the witness of the Bible, the instruction of the Bible, know that the call to be alert to the fact that the end is near, the certainty that it's near, the implications that we are facing an end and that the end is not far off should influence our thinking. We know we're familiar with that language. But often, like earthquake preparedness, it sort of recedes in significance, and we don't know how to think, and kind of we lose our response. And I want to take us into Peter's instruction here and hope that we'll both hear from him and be changed by what we hear. We know that the day of the Lord will come like a thief. A thief in the night, all were saying peace and you know, so on. The language everywhere on that day will be contradicting the events that are to come. Assuming everything will be fine, and the day of the Lord will come like a thief in the night, and everything will change. You remember what Jesus said of the rich fool who had gathered everything into barns and was making plans for spending his money on himself. And in the parable, the Lord speaks to the man and says, "You fool, this night your soul is required of you." The end is near. We know that it's going to come in history. Jesus said always to be watchful, to expect his coming. We don't know when it will be. We should therefore always be expectant. And in addition, none of us know the end of our own life, when it will finally cease. It could be today. Even though there's no reason to predict it, events could happen that cause us to be in the presence of the Lord, the end being near as our life concludes. Maxine Bradford is sitting over to my left today with her son and some others. 2 weeks ago, she and Roy were sitting here together in this church. This church is 62 years old, and for almost all of that history, the Bradfords were here. It's hard for me to think of this place without them here. And yet Roy has, last Wednesday, died and gone to be with the Lord. I remember when I first came here as a freshman in college, some of the first people I was aware of and knew and appreciated were the Bradfords. When I first started on the staff here, Roy was an elder in the church, and he invested himself in me. Sometimes, you know, he had opinions, let me say, about what I ought to be doing. And whether I agreed with them always or not, I knew they were motivated by love for Jesus and love for me. And yet the end is near, that all of us know there is a terminus out there. So the question is, how do we stand? How do we think? How do we make choices with these certainties in place? Up until this time, Peter has mostly been talking about the world of our circumstances, which we know we can't change. So we will speak of suffering and deprivation and difficulty in this life. We are to be in the world, but not of the world, sojourning here, not free to change the world to our perspective, knowing that we will have difficulties, we will have misunderstandings, and the perspective has mostly been, you can't change that. Bad governments will do what they do, and we're in no position to fix them. Bad masters in economic circumstances, slavery in their case, might well continue to be bad masters. And you have to decide that you will find Christ in the middle of your hard circumstances without being able to predict they'll change. Hard marriages, same thing. And so Peter's been giving us instruction in how to be strong in faith, how to find the Lord, how to bear up under difficulties, knowing that tomorrow and the next day and the day after that may well be as difficult as today. And will the Lord strengthen me? But the perspective he's adding, beginning today in the verses we're going to read, is that though we cannot predict change of our circumstances and we cannot bring about change in our circumstances, the day is coming when the Lord will change everything. There is an end to it all. He will honor his own. He will raise us up. He will smite the wicked. He will do away with patterns of sin and destruction that are everywhere in the world. There is an end coming, and it is an end in which he intervenes in our favor. And that's what he'll speak of now and help orient us towards in the section we're going to study today. We noted at the end of chapter 3 that he spoke of history from Noah to the ascension of Christ, the time of Noah, and his essential point is that Jesus is Lord of history. In verse 5 of chapter 4, which we considered also last week, he says, those who slander and persecute Christians will have to give an account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead. There is a day coming when the Lord will intervene on our behalf. So there's two paragraphs that we're going to consider, beginning in verse 7, ending in verse 19, the end of chapter 4. There are two paragraphs and two big ideas. I'm actually going to take them in reverse order, but the two big ideas are these. The end of all things is at hand, therefore, buy up opportunity. If there's an end point out there somewhere, it means that everything is not going to go along exactly the way it is, and you will only have opportunities to learn and grow and act and serve and love. Only so many opportunities. Don't miss out. Buy up the opportunities. That's the first big idea. The second is that judgment is coming. For it is time for judgment to begin, we read in verse 17. And the fact that we know that the judgment here means an accounting of things. This is not judgment between those who will be with the Lord forever and those who will not be with him. It's not the judgment of the righteous and the unrighteous. This is an accounting of the lives of those who are servants of Christ, where we will sit with him in his presence someday and have his take on our life. Have his word to us about who we are and what we've been and the gifts of our character we give to him, he'll receive from us. It's that sort of judgment. And if that's true, what are the implications for us? If our lives will be reviewed by him someday, what are the implications? So those are the two paragraphs. I'm going to take the second of these, beginning in verse 12 first, because I want to spend most of our time actually on the first section, verses 7 through 11. But we'll come back to that. Verse 12. Dear friends, do not be surprised at the painful trial you are suffering. The word painful trial there is actually the fiery event that has come to try you. It's the word for fire is in there. And I think it has in mind cleansing fire, purifying fire. We'll come back to that. As though something strange were happening to you, but rejoice that you participate in the sufferings of Christ so that you may be overjoyed when his glory is revealed. For if you are insulted because of the name of Christ, you are blessed. For the spirit of glory and of God rests on you. If you suffer, it should not be as a murderer or a thief or any other kind of criminal or even as a meddler. However, if you suffer as a Christian, do not be ashamed, but praise God that you bear that name. For it is time for judgment to begin with the family of God, and if it begins with us, what will the outcome be for those who do not obey the gospel of God? And if it is hard for the righteous to be saved, what will become of the ungodly and the sinner? Verse 18 is actually a quotation from Proverbs. And the idea here is that it is with hardship or with difficulty that the righteous are saved. What then will become of the unrighteous? So, verse 19, so then, those who suffer according to God's will should commit themselves to their faithful Creator and continue to do good. Peter has had a lot to say about suffering, and the Bible taken as a whole has a great deal more to say about suffering. And there are no easy answers. There are no simple formulas. There are no gathering up of all ideas. The pain and hardship and unfairness that befall human beings, we are actually taught and meant to understand that there is deep mystery in the fact that people suffer, especially suffer for righteousness' sake. So we don't have all the answers. And what we've already seen in this letter is that sometimes suffering circumstances teach us to have faith and confidence in the presence of God that we wouldn't have otherwise. It is about our current experience of God and learning to worship. It is certainly about witness. Peter's already made that point, that sometimes we are put in hard and suffering circumstances because we have a word to say about God to the world that won't hear us talk about anything else. But if they see us as a different kind of people, they'll listen. So sometimes it's about witness. But in this case, this paragraph, I think, these verses are about purification. And that's another of the roles that suffering, fiery suffering, purifying fire plays in our lives. That we are being fitted for eternity. We are being decoupled from all of our pleasures and fleshliness and foolishness, our love of ourselves, our delight in the spotlight. The pampering of our kind of petty ideas and little programs for promotion of ourselves and so on. We're so used to having us be the biggest deal in the world. And somehow we have to end that addiction. Somehow we have to learn that Christ be greater and we be less. So there's surgery that takes place, and surgery is hard. And surgery is sometimes painful, but there is a cleansing that is taking place in this. And the day will come when we go to be with the Lord that the character that's been formed over a lifetime, we'll offer it to Him as a gift. And moments of moral courage and patience and love for others and beauty that we've been allowed to participate in, we will take these with us into His presence and we'll give them to Him. The judgment here is that of a cleansing fire. It's in verse 17. It says, "It is time for judgment to begin with the family of God." That the day is coming in the world when the world will be judged, and it begins with making the people of God who they ought to be. And it's a good thing. It's something we ought to rejoice in. Peter says, "We will find the presence of Christ in this. It is His sufferings that we undergo, and He being there with us." We're being made who we ought to be, who we long to be, and we would not learn these lessons if the hardship wasn't required of us. We would continue always to stay small and self-contained and unconcerned for others if the difficulty didn't require us to become bigger people, more dependent on the Lord. So I think suffering, as it's being described here, is attached to judgment. The day is coming when we'll all be examined and we are being made ready for that day. A couple things just to say before moving on to the other consideration is that, and Peter has mentioned this a couple times, we easily fool ourselves in suffering. We sometimes will say that I am being treated badly by someone else. And I don't deserve it, and this is evidence of my godliness and the great surgery God's doing to make me like Jesus. And the reason we're being treated badly is because we have treated someone else badly. Is that we've earned the pushback, the rejection, the harsh word, the diminishment, the deprivation, whatever it is. Whatever the hard thing is, we've earned it because we're sinners. We sow seeds and to the flesh and we reap corruption. So He is saying this, be warned. We can sometimes pretend that what we're going through is godly when it isn't. And we should examine ourselves. It's interesting, he uses, you know, murderer and a thief and so on, that don't be one of those, don't be judged for those things. And then he says troublesome meddler at the end of of verse 15. And I was reading an old Dave Roper sermon on this subject, and he was talking about, that seems kind of odd, you know, thieves and murders and so on, and then meddlers. How that's on the list, it's not clear. But it is clear that meddlesome people very often are not liked well. People that are too much in other people's business find themselves rejected for that reason. And he quoted an epitaph on a tombstone, making the point. Erected by her sorrowing brothers in memory of Martha Clay, here lies one who lived for others. Now she has peace, and so have they. So the examination is this: do not assume that all the pushback we get in life is for God's sake, but it is sometimes. And it is sometimes doing the great work of helping us become free of ourselves, of purifying us and letting us let go of our flesh. And it's a good thing, and we should rejoice when that's so. Well, let's go back to the other big idea. Judgment is one. So the end of everything is near. The end of all things is near, and we know that means that someday we are going to stand before the Lord and our lives will be examined and accounted for. It will be loving. He will never be anything but loving with us, but it will be truthful as well. And so we take that into account, and we take serious things about life seriously. But the other thing, beginning in verse 7, going back now, that we can think of and be aware of is that life has only so many opportunities in it. And our tendency is to keep saying, well, tomorrow, next week, later on, I'll get around to it, some other time. And we sort of procrastinate, and squeaky wheels get the grease, and important things don't happen. And pretty soon you realize an awful lot has gone by, and the opportunities are now even fewer and fewer than they were. So he's saying, if the end is near, let's do the important things. Let's focus on what's really worth the attention. And there are four things. Let me read, beginning in verse 7. The end of all things is near, therefore, be clear-minded and self-controlled so that you can pray. Above all, love each other deeply, because love covers a multitude of sins. Offer hospitality to one another without grumbling. Each of you should use whatever gift he has received to serve faithfully, to serve others faithfully, administering God's grace in its various forms. If anyone speaks, he should do it as one speaking the very words of God. If anyone serves, he should do it with the strength God provides, so that in all things God may be praised through Jesus Christ. To him be the glory and power forever and ever. Amen. Four things: prayer, fervent love for others, hospitality, and use of the gifts God's given us. This is not a dramatic list, is it? This is not a bucket list. You know the movie, The Bucket List, it's a story that's been told other times in other ways of somebody realizing they only have a few months left to live. And in this case, it was two men who had the same kind of death sentence. And they realized that they were going to go do all the things they'd never done, travel to the farthest place, have the most exotic experiences, have dramatic conversations and go interesting places. And the end is near, therefore, we'll do something of that sort. This is exactly the opposite kind of list. These are things that are eternally important, but they're not particularly dramatic. We are being called here to give priority to things that will, again, will shape us forever, will leave behind, when our time does come, when the end does come for us, we'll leave behind something that's worthwhile, that will really make a difference. And the first of them is prayer. Clear-minded, self-controlled into prayer. Now, the point he's making is this. He's not saying the end of all things is at hand, sort of like you're careening off a cliff. You're just at the very edge of the cliff. Clear your minds and shoot up a prayer at the last minute. That's not the picture he's saying. He's saying, knowing that the end is near, we should be the kind of people who are habitually in prayer. And clear-mindedness goes with prayer. Being able to think clearly, being able to evaluate what's important, being able to weigh what's worth our attention and effort and involvement, to have a clear mind and thoughtful discipline and find ourselves often in prayer and deeply in prayer and regularly in prayer, those go together. When we pray, we become smaller. We become diminished. We become less important to ourselves, and God becomes greater. In his heart, in his promises, in his passions, in his beauty, all of these become greater to us. And we take into his presence all the things that concern us, and we find he transforms them to something else. And Peter's saying if the end is near, we should be people who are in the habit and pattern of prayer. It's a priority that's worth giving ourselves to. And I need to confess, as I was preparing this message, this is not new information to me. It's not the first time I've thought this, but it's enormously convicting to me how easy it is for my mind to be distracted by everything else, how hard a concerted habit of prayer is, how often I've started over and fallen back and started over and fallen back. But it remains the first priority on this list for a good reason. If we want to put first things first as a church, as individuals, as God's people, we will be clear-minded and disciplined for a life of prayer. And we'll find that we've done the best thing, the best first thing. Secondly, he says, love fervently. Love each other deeply. And the rationale for love is interesting. It says that love covers a multitude of sins. I think the point he's making is this, is that when people are trapped in something, when they have acted in rebellion and they are receiving the consequences of their rebellion, how can we possibly help? What can we do to get involved with the out of control brokenness that's around us, and sins grow and they feed on one another and they grow more again, where sins claim greater ownership of people. Consequences grow heavier, and as they grow heavier, sin reigns even further. How does that cycle ever get broken? It's by love. That it's love that breaks the power of sin. It's love that covers it over. It's love that salves the wound. It is the most powerful weapon in the armor of those who would serve God. Changing the course of awful events, sin predicting one thing, love covering it, and bringing about what's good instead of what's horrible. A great priority. The end is near. Be people of prayer, be those who love. Who make love our habit, love our investment, love our involvement, who look for ways to love. And the power of sin is broken. The third priority is also a bit curious. It doesn't seem, you know, we can make a case for prayer and love as being sort of big Bible ideas. They show up frequently. The third of them is hospitality. And that seems a bit like too small a thing on one level, I think. The term hospitality means to love strangers. And in the ancient world, in the first century, the time that Peter wrote this, there were not very good ways for people to travel from one place to another and find lodging. There weren't good motels and, you know, internets you could make, you know, arrangements on ahead of time, and credit cards to pay them with, and, you know, make arrangements for your shelter whenever you went someplace. You had to depend, especially as Christians, as if you travel, you had to depend on somebody to put you up. And so the idea is not entertainment. Hospitality is not the same thing as entertainment, where you're in a social network and you agree to throw the party this time and someone else is going to throw the party next time, and we're being hospitable and we're sort of acting on prearranged commitment to one another. This is people who are outsiders, who are strangers, who need shelter. And I think probably for us to think well of this, a better word for hospitality is shelter, actually. Providing shelter. And in our part of the world, it's obviously not true everywhere, there certainly are people in our part of the world that don't have shelter, some. But the vast majority of people that we interact with in our part of the world most of the time, if they needed to have a roof over their heads, could find a way tonight to get a roof over their heads, most people. But there are an enormous number of folks who need shelter, who are emotionally so lost and frightened and alone and abandon, they need somebody to take them in. They need somebody to say welcome. They need somebody to say you belong. It's shelter of a different kind than just the mere providing of a roof over the head. It's the shelter of being believed in and cared about, reached out to, invited. My mother's picture is there. She will be 88 in a few days. She just started in her 88th year as a blogger. To the delight of all her grandchildren, I must say, they've helped her become a blogger. She wrote a cookbook once, recipe book. It had a bunch of her philosophy of life stuff in it. And so now the blog is going to be recipes and Grandma Z's blog, Grandma Z's philosophy of life blog. And obviously at her age and some stuff that's going on with my dad, and I've been more regularly trying to find time to talk to her. If I can't be there, at least talk. And I realize how much I appreciate my mother's take on things. I started thinking back to all of my life and how often her perspective was a shelter, a welcome, a kind of making things turn out better, some degree of emotional understanding, some raising up from the depths, and it's still true. I like talking to her. And I realize that's someone, and obviously I wasn't a stranger, I was her son, but there's a lot of people that just little conversations with her and kind of the ability to put a thing right that isn't right in a relationship. And I think that's what why Peter makes this such a one of the four things that he will advocate, you know, the end being near. What should we give ourselves to? Prayer and love, but sheltering others. There are folks in this church who I admire immensely, who are taking in foster kids, who are inviting families to live under their roof, who are finding ways to physically shelter people that need help, but much more than the roof over the head being offered in all of these cases is the arm around the shoulder and the word of invitation and a sense of being given the gift of belonging when you don't feel like you belong anywhere. It's a great priority to have. Prayer and love for sinners and shelter for those who are in need. The fourth priority given here is the use of one's spiritual gifts. Verse 10, each one should use whatever gift he has to serve others. Now, the New Testament is very clear that when we come to Christ and become the home of the Spirit of God, we are given a capacity to serve. We're all important. Every one of us is on the team. We are part of the work of God. We are part of the community of God. We have a contribution to make, and we are given a way to make the contribution. And Peter divides them into two parts. Some are going to speak mostly as their contribution. They'll have something to say. And he says if you have a speaking gift of whatever sort, in individual conversation or in a group or whatever, speak as if you're speaking the words of God. That the gifts we have are gifts of the Spirit, are for His purpose. Say God's truth and assume He's going to use it. If you're called to speak, speak that way. If, on the other hand, you're called to serve, and a great many of the gifts God gives are gifts for mercy, the showing of mercy and the binding of wounds and getting involved and sort of being active, hands-on, physical care, emotional care, you know, providing of stuff, all of those kinds of gifts. If you do those, serve with the fullest possible heart, the very strength God provides. But be sure of this, you've got something to do. The end of everything is near. The end of all things is at hand. Take up the calling. Don't let your life be siphoned off paying attention to all kinds of other things, hobbies and entertainments and professional striving and all that sort of thing. But realize that God has use to make of you and throw yourself into being used. So the perspective that Peter has added to the letter that has been there before but not nearly as clear is that the hard circumstances of the world cannot be changed by us. If you get assigned a difficult thing, and slavery was one that we spoke of a few weeks ago, those assigned to slavery in this time may very well not be able to change that. And they need to trust God if they're given a hard assignment. And we know that there is mystery in suffering that we'll never understand all the reasons for. But sometimes a perspective that the end is coming is very important for us in understanding how to step into the lives we're called to live. We can't change circumstances, but someday God will. And the choices we're making now are fitting us for that day. And He will someday speak to us of our lives. He will speak well of us. He will speak in love of us. But He will speak truthfully about the choices we've made, the things we've given ourselves to. And if these things are true and opportunities don't go on forever, what should we do? What's worth having as a priority? Prayer. Fervent love for people who are broken. Sheltering those who are in need. Knowing what the calling you have, the gift you have, and using it well, and using it with passion and the power of God. The end is near. The earthquake's coming. I don't know if you're prepared or not for the earthquake that's going to someday hit Northern California. That's an important question, but this is much more important. We don't know when our story is going to be over, but we know what will happen when the story is over. And we can be motivated to be about the right things. We can be certain the story will be over, and we can be motivated to be about the right things. Let's pray. Lord, help us hear and believe and be changed by what we hear and believe. Grant us insight. Clear away cobwebs. Strengthen us. Thank you for our chance to be together before your word this morning. In Jesus' name.